the hole in a toilet on the spacecraft is small. So you practice and you make sure it goes in there, but every now and then you could have an escapee. And, you know, that's not what, something you want to deal with in a small little capsule.
What happens when you have a baby Ruth that's escaped now? What do you do?
It's not pretty. It's not pretty. It's better when you're off by yourself in your own little corner of the space station and you can deal with your own emergency and not have to tell anybody. But
this is stuff no one thinks
yeah,
of.
Yeah, no one thinks about it, but it's real.
Hey guys, welcome to a brand new episode of Yolitics. You know, we're on the road for this episode.
We
do not often talk about resumes on this show because ours are so light.
Yeah, but and so we don't like to bring that up.
No need. I mean, we could skate through it pretty quickly. But we're going to talk about a resume today of our guest. Which
pages
is
long and all of it's
unbelievable.
Amazing.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes of this episode is going to be his resume, just the highlights of it here. This is a repeat guest we have on. It's Chris Cassidy. A retired NASA astronaut, former Navy SEAL. He's a veteran of three space flights, STS-127 on the shuttle back in 2009, Expedition 35 and 63 to the International Space Station aboard the Russian Soyuz capsule. 378 days total in space. I saw 377 and 378. Which one is it, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's how you round.
Okay, all right.
I love
We're going to round up, all right?
Round up.
Let's round up. Benefit fits the resume.
Benefit the base runner.
Yeah, exactly. 10 spacewalks, the 500th person in history to fly into space, and then the chief of the astronaut office at NASA, which is a big deal. But here's what cracks me up. This doesn't crack me up, but it's amazing. Before NASA, he had an accomplished military career.
Yeah.
Captain in the U.S. Navy, 11 years as a member of the U.S. Navy's SEALs team. Deployed twice to Afghanistan, and everything else I'm told is classified. We can't discuss.
I would imagine that's probably podcast. Correct.
Chris, welcome back, man. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you guys. Thanks.
Thanks for having
exciting
us.
Exciting week in space travel.
It's a big week in space travel, isn't it?
It is. People are getting excited about this, those who've been watching it. But, you know, Jason and I were talking about this. So we're getting ready for this Artemis II mission around the moon and back. And it just feels like this hasn't gotten a lot of discussion. Like, you don't hear about it. You don't, you know, see it constantly on TV. And
well, there's a whole
shocking.
Lot of other things that distract our nation right now. So it'll be great to have a positive thing that can be highlighted.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, we've talked before about how this is one of those things that, you know, as divided as we are, and this is a very polarized country, this is one of those things that people can still rally around, no matter what their stripes are. The space program and these achievements, and the being daring enough to dream something really big and to actually pursue it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, space travel does that. We're still partnered. We were talking before the show started. We're still flying with the Russian colleagues, Russian cosmonauts. We're still partnering on the International Space Station. In my opinion, space travel is one of the unique things in our world that can do something like that and pull countries together that are having odd times on the ground and in normal life. But space travel transcends all that and allows people to get along and work together in harmony. And I think ultimately when people are marching around on Mars, it'll be multiple countries doing it together, and that's how we'll be successful in that type of big endeavor. And the first step there is this week going around the moon.
Is that going to happen in our lifetime, marching around on Mars?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
I do, yeah. People joke internally that Mars is always 15 years away, you know, because it's that technically we could do it, but you have to throw substantial money at it. We have to be committed as a nation, and not just one nation. I firmly believe it's a partnership as a multiple nations, and that's a lot. That takes a lot of focus, a lot of diligent planning. Everybody's capable of doing it, but there needs to be a function that forces it. And competition did that for the moon in the 70s, and to some degree it's doing it now. The Chinese have some plans to get to the moon, and so we certainly don't want them to beat us back there. So that's driving it a little bit right now. So I don't know, but to answer your question, yes, I believe we'll see people walking on Mars before the three of us leave this planet.
Wow. And let's lay this out, what's happening with the Artemis II mission here. So people might be listening to this and say, well, what are you talking about? We have, you know, people in space right now aboard the International Space Station. What's significant about this is the space station is in low Earth orbit, essentially not too far away from the planet. Mm-hmm. But this is the moon. It requires you to get outside of low Earth orbit. Talk to us about the significance of this, why this is such a big deal, why people should be paying attention to this, because it hasn't happened since we were all, you know, wearing diapers.
Yeah. So we've had a permanent human presence on the International Space Station since 2001. And that success that we've had as a nation and partner nations, I think to some degree has caused people to think that going to space is easy. And SpaceX pulls it off, and they do an amazing job. And there's other companies now that are very successful in launching equipment to space. And you see a rocket, first stage rocket, come down and land at sea on a platform. Try holding a pencil in your palm and keeping it balanced, and give you an idea of how hard that is. So my point is that it's made it seem like it's kind of, we've got space wired. Going to space is hard. It's difficult. There's a lot of risk. There's a lot that has to go perfect. So the people are a little anesthetized to all of that. Now, getting to the moon is significant in the complexity, higher than going in low Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit's about 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, and the moon is about 250,000 miles from Earth. So, and you also have to break the gravitational pull, which means you not only have to get in Earth orbit, and these guys will spend about a day in Earth orbit, about 24 hours, doing some checkouts and proximity operations with some of the components, and then fire their big engine, which is called the TLI burn, translunar insertion, which is NASA code for a big giant engine firing to break the pulls of gravity to send you on a trajectory to intercept lunar gravity. So way more complicated than going to the International Space Station, and way more risky.
And we talked a little bit about Mars, and you know, there are people who go, well, why don't we just go do that? It's not a first step that you do, and that's what this mission is about. And I think a lot of folks have wondered, why are we going back to the moon? We've been to the moon. We did that years ago. This is part of it. You have, you know, brand new technology that you're using. These four astronauts, in fact, are going to be, as I understand it, going further away than any other human has ever gone. They're going to go on around the dark side of the moon and then back. How crucial is that to getting to Mars, and how does that line up?
Yeah, and in simple human terms, you could drive your new car across a desert that'll take you a week to get across the desert with no support there, right out of the factory, having never turned that vehicle on. It would be a little riskier than if you take that new car and you drive around your neighborhood, you make sure you know how all the things work, you're confident in its operations. I'm dumbing it down.
No, that's
but
great.
It's very prudent to test incrementally things before you commit to something that you can't get back from. Going to the moon is risky and hard, but it's a couple days to come back. And the way this particular trajectory is, they get a free return back to Earth from the TLI burn. Mm-hmm. They don't have to do another burn to get back. And once you commit to going to Mars, there's no coming back until you get to Mars 6 or 7 months later. So you really want to be confident that all your equipment is working and everything's functioning. So think of it like a test drive, test operation of whatever piece of machinery that is comfortable in your head to think about. That's what we're doing.
And so the Artemis II mission is a test flight. So they're not actually landing on the moon. They're just going to circle it a few times here. But talk to us a moment about the International Space Station. I've heard for years that, its useful life is almost done. It's going to be 2020, then 2025. Now I think it's 2030 is when it's supposed to be decommissioned and sent back onto the controlled reentry back into the Pacific Ocean. When we talk about the Artemis II flight, what's the whole purpose of this? Is it it's not to find landing zones, but what's the whole purpose of it? Just to test the rockets, to test the engines like you were talking about, to make sure that we're solid on this before we actually
put
a space station on the moon?
Same type of concept as Apollo had incremental plans to get to the lunar surface. And if you remember, Apollo 8 was the famous mission that went around the moon, very close to it, but didn't land. And they took that first famous photo of Earthrise coming up from the lunar orbit. Very same concept. It's testing, and there's some key pieces that need to be successful. The rendezvous in low Earth orbit that's what they're testing on those first 24 hours, and then testing the life support system. Life support system is a huge part that needs to be kind of put through the paces, and certainly they're testing life support systems as they live in there for those 10 days of the mission.
The whole idea, though, is when the ISS, the International Space Station, goes away, the idea is to put a space station on the moon, right?
So there's been some different concepts throughout the last couple of years. And just last week, NASA announced this a new program called the Ignition Program. And I quite truthfully need to do a little more self-digging and understand every step of it. But it involves many sorties to the moon with rovers and data collection, and then ultimately more people and incrementally building up to the point where we have a lunar presence on the surface of the moon. Prior to that, there was a concept called the Lunar Gateway, which was analogous to the International Space Station, but in the orbit of the moon. And you do like elevator rides. If when you go to lunar surface, you go down, spend a couple hours, days, I don't remember, yeah, and then go back and do your real living in lunar orbit. They've kind of, NASA's just now announcing, like a week ago, we're scrapping that Lunar Gateway, Lunar Space Station concept, and going all in on lunar surface. So I need to get smarter on it myself, but that's generally the concept.
Well, that's a big deal to think about. This isn't, you know, this is 250,000 miles away.
Yeah.
This is not just a quick shot up, you know, 250 miles up in low Earth orbit.
Yeah, it sure is. And you're going to need all kinds of trades, in my opinion. You're going to need plumbers, electricians. You're going to need people that can get after it with a shovel and operate heavy machinery. So
on the moon?
On the moon, yeah. It's interesting to think about it. I don't think they're not going to, it'll change the paradigm of astronaut selection, in my opinion. It's not going to be all
how so?
PhD researchers, I don't think. You need smart people, but you also need people that know those technical skills. And everybody's trainable on everything. So It'll be interesting to see what the astronaut core looks like in the out years of lunar operations.
Yeah, because if you're building a community, you're going to need all of these different
skills. You need all the stuff, yeah.
And especially in an environment like that. Can you talk a little bit about, you've been an engineer on a flight into space. You've been a commander. When you look at this one, and I'm sure you've read up on this and followed this, you know the four astronauts personally who are going to be on this mission, the three Americans and one Canadian. With that former background as the engineer on the flight or the commander, what do you think is the most challenging aspect of this when you think as an engineer or when you think of it as a commander in charge of it?
I think the technical things, they're well-trained. Mission Control's well-trained. They've gone through at least about 4 years, if I recall correctly, of training as an integrated team, the ground teams and the crew. So the technical stuff, it's a challenge, it's hard. The machines are gonna throw curveballs at you that you don't know what it is yet. I think, so that's all to say, I think the biggest challenge is not that. It's knowing that the world is watching with awe and excitement as you leave, as that rocket lights, and every call you make, people are listening to. That's pretty heavy stuff. And the four of them are super professional and super squared away and couldn't have better four to do this mission. But it's interesting to think about. And if we know now how the world listened with bated breath to Neil saying those initial words as he stepped on the surface. And now these guys aren't walking on the surface, but it's been a long time since we've had people seeing the moon closer than they're seeing the Earth. And it's just really cool, and to think about what that means to the humans.
That's funny that you say that, though, because I would think that you would be overwhelmed with the technical aspects of this, and that once you leave Earth, you would almost just put all of those people there out of your mind, and you wouldn't be thinking about, this is a big deal, and we got to get every single thing right because everybody's watching.
Yeah, they're definitely focused on the procedures. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that they're willy-nilly kind of winging it to the moon. They're certainly focused on every switch throw, every piece of telemetry. That's part of the deal of being an astronaut. But there's other parts of it too that occupy little slivers of your brain that are pretty significant.
Wow. The space shuttle's retired for folks who may not have kept up with this here, but can you talk about how different the Orion spacecraft is compared to the space shuttle that people may be really familiar with over the last several decades?
Yeah. So just basic architecture, the space shuttle, a winged vehicle with landing gear. Why do you have that? So you can land on a runway. When does that stuff help you? The moment of touchdown. So you're carrying a lot of weight and a lot of equipment and a lot of systems that are only of use to you for one time, a big part of it, landing. You want to do that successfully, but it's a tiny portion. So going to space, and particularly going to space beyond low Earth orbit and space exploration, is in the designing the mission, you fret every ounce, every pound costs money and fuel and propulsion. So you want the vehicle to be as light as possible, to the point of, okay, is it a two-person capsule or three or four? Every person comes, not just the weight of the person, but added consumables for food, added consumables for the bathroom, added consumables for water consumption and oxygen consumption. So it goes on and on and on. So it's this trade-off of how big can we make it, and what's the mission? If you can then scrub a big portion of weight, wings, hydraulic systems, landing gear, you're better off.
Payload.
And oh, by the way, the guys with slide rulers in the 1950s and 60s nailed it perfectly, that the heat shield is pretty much the best way to keep the crew safe. We saw it on the space shuttle. The wings need to be very robust on the leading edges of those wings, and they had thermal tiles. Well, foam came off the tank, and you think, how in the world can a piece of foam crack a hard structure? Well, at very high speeds, there's enough energy and a lot of things to do damage, and it did. So,
but this is a capsule. You guys, for years, were in a space truck, essentially.
Yeah.
This is going back old school, but this is a smart way to do it, huh?
Old school's one way to think of it, but I don't think of it as old school. I think there's ways you can design something, and the capsule form is very pure and robust in nature, because you can tumble through the atmosphere. It'll right itself into the right, correct orientation. The shuttle could go out of control. If you have the top side going into the atmosphere first, you have no chance. So you put a lot of safety and redundancies into the system when you go with the capsule, and then it's just a matter of how do you angle the sides. I mean, I'm not a design engineer, but I do appreciate the elegance of a capsule, and I'm in awe that guys and girls with calculators that could, you know, they were better off doing the longhand division by on paper and slide rulers got it so perfect back then. One other thing about the capsule design is that you have to have, that requires a parachute, and so then that's how you get your safety with landing, as redundant parachute systems
in the water somewhere,
in the water or land. That's a trade-off decision too, and the Russians choose to land on land. The nice thing about that is once you land, the mission is over. You're done. It's a more severe landing. It's a higher impact G load to the people and the equipment. Whereas if you land in the water, it's a little softer. But guess what? The mission isn't over till you're safely on that ship.
They pull you out.
And anything can happen in the ocean.
So when you landed in the Soyuz, You came back in the Soyuz, right?
Obviously. I did. Yeah.
I mean, you guys land in what, Kazakhstan? Is that where we're
in? Middle of nowhere in Kazakhstan, yeah.
How is that, like a car wreck? Are you hitting the ground at 50 miles an hour? What is that
Not
like?
Not 50, but maybe 25. It's okay. Think about driving a Volkswagen Bug into a brick wall at 25 miles an hour. You're not going to die, but it's a pretty good hit. Mm-hmm. You're strapped in, your knees are in like a cannonball position, and there's cargo straps over your knees. You're in this very tight position because that's kind of safest for your body. And then the seats, which are cocked down for most of the mission, get released right before landing, and they go up on these spring-loaded systems. And the liner of your seat is this honeycomb aluminum material so that your body scrunches the honeycomb when you land. So there's several ways the energy is dissipated, but the energy is there, it's real, and you know you hit. The procedure even says, cross your arms, close your teeth, and make sure your tongue is not in your teeth.
Oh, jeez.
I didn't know the word for tongue in Russian, and when we got in my first simulator, I'm like, hey guys, what's this word right here? And my crewmate was like,
you don't want
bite it off, right?
You don't want that between your teeth. Somebody probably learned that the hard way.
It's in the regulations, right?
Let's talk about this brings together this Artemis program is bringing together all kinds of bedfellows here, because for a long time it seemed like we were, you know, is it going to be SpaceX? Is it going to be Blue Origin? You know, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk. This kind of brings all of them together, NASA, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, I mean, just tons and tons of players. This is, as you said, a very complex thing to do, and you almost need all hands on deck here. But I think for so long we were watching this race between these different private companies wondering who's going to be the one, and it turns out it's all of them.
Yeah, I mean, low Earth orbit is an area where there's viable business cases for private companies, you know, whether it's launch services, satellite service, communication kind of world. There's plenty of business cases, and companies are having great success and making money and advancing technology and all those things. Going to the moon and certainly to Mars is much more complicated, and I think a little harder for an individual business to have a successful money-making business. You know, ultimately business is about returning money to stockholders or making, not bleeding money. Mm-hmm. And so those longer, harder, deep exploratory missions, in my opinion, you're going to probably see this combination of multi-companies having different contracts, and the government sort of being the integrator of all those contracts. And so it's still our nation's commercial space industry working hard, just kind of packaged in a different way.
Yeah, we talked about the moon, you mentioned Mars, and you mentioned this earlier on about China, but I'm curious whether you think that this focus on the moon first, and it's a stepping stone to get to Mars and get that, but is this really about science, do you think, or is this geopolitics and trying to be first back to the moon?
Well,
We'd
be fooling ourselves if say that geopolitics doesn't play a role in it. These kind of costly, expensive things span election cycles. They cross political ideologies, so they're hard and complex and emotional things to get behind. And they need a forcing function, in my opinion. And I think geopolitics is that forcing function.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You've never seen this view that these people are about to see, these four astronauts. What are they in for? When you see Earthrise, as they call it, when you're kind of on the other side of the moon and you see Earth come up over mm-hmm. the moon, where, you know, we're used to seeing the moon coming up over the horizon. What are they in for?
Just kind of struck by the beauty of Earth. Even in low Earth orbit, I talk about it often when I'm giving public presentations, but you just see our majestic planet. You don't see the traffic on I-30 or 20 or whatever your favorite road is, but you see blue, green, brown, white clouds and mountaintops and all those things, and it's just our home. And the skinny little blue sliver that's the atmosphere keeping us all safe. And that's just from that 250 miles where you only see a portion of Earth below you because we're not high enough to see the whole thing. They're going to see the whole blue marble in one picture frame. And pictures are cool, but it's like showing your Grand Canyon trip to your friends. They're bored after the second one. But it was way more amazing when you were there and you're looking around like, oh my gosh, this is really cool. Same kind of thing.
Are you envious at all of these guys on this mission?
Yeah, I mean, all of us former astronauts, I'm sure, are. You know, I was glad when I was a chief astronaut that I didn't have to assign the four of them. That assignment came. That's the job of the chief astronaut, is to assign the crews.
Why are you glad you didn't have to?
Because it was like, who do you pick? Huh. And it's a big deal, and you want everybody to have the attention. Anyway, they're great. All four great folks, individual people as well as teammates. So they'll have a great mission.
What's going through their minds right now? I mean, we're, you know, as we record this, we are right before the first launch opportunity, a day away. What's going through their minds right now?
So they had their thing called the wave across the ditch yesterday. So they're in quarantine, which now that we've had COVID, everybody knows what the word quarantine means.
Wait, what's the wave across the ditch?
Yeah, that's what I'm about to tell you. Okay. So they're in quarantine. They can't be seen by friends and family. Friends and family are there visiting to watch the launch. To keep the quarantine pure and keep isolation, there is a road that has an actual ditch on the side of the road, just like any road you've seen. And the families are on one side of the parking lot, and the crew is on the other side of the road. So the road keeps the quarantine active. But that's the final time when friends and family, particularly family, can see their loved one before they go into the building and the whole launch sequence kind of starts. So they've said goodbye to their people in the wave, and now I don't know exactly what their timing would be today. So we're a little over probably 36 hours from launch or something like that. They are just all about gear, equipment, making sure they're, probably being done with email right about now. That's what I tried to do each of my launches. Computer stuff done 24 hours before launch. You don't want to be like right up to
they're calling you. Come on, Chris.
Turning your phone off. Although phones probably, they'll probably have their phones and texting right up until, they start putting their suits on and whatnot. But, just focused on the mission, making sure they've everything they've done. But at this point, the stuff is done. It's really just how fast can the clock tick to get to loading the capsule.
Talk about anxiety. Discuss with us for a moment here about the health dangers, the psychological effects of being that far away. And secondly, is there more radiation when you get outside Earth's magnetic field?
Radiation is a thing that we are deeply concerned about on all aspects of space travel. The crew members will wear dosimeters, little radiation detection device, on their body. There's some scattered throughout the vehicle. But quite truthfully, we're encumbered by the same regulations that an OSHA nuclear power plant worker has, or an airline pilot, lifetime exposure. So it's not anything different than any other human would be exposed to. So we just monitor it, and you are exposed, and there's solar flares, and there's predictive analysis on solar flares and all these things.
Yeah.
So it's out there. It's a risk, just like launch and reentry and spacewalks. They all pose different risk factors to the mission.
How about psychologically, though? These astronauts are about to do something no one in this generation has done.
This is my opinion. Maybe it's the knuckle-dragger military guy in me, but I don't think there's any big psychological thing to it other than what we talked about earlier, the fact that 8 billion people, well, there's probably some that aren't listening, but are listening to every radio that call they make and watching the launch. And so the weight of doing something that the planet cares about is there. But the psychological thing of cruising 3 days to the moon, I think they're just going to be more like, hey, who ate my cookie?
the real things that matter.
Yes, exactly.
Those kind of arguments really do happen.
Oh, they happen, yeah. Food is a big deal here and there, so it's like you want to eat what you want to eat.
Do you solve your arguments differently up there?
No, but little things can be annoying that you wouldn't necessarily think about, like going to the bathroom, not to be funny, but in the space station, it's a large facility. The bathroom's all off to itself. You're going to use it. If it's number, you're doing number one or number two, you largely got the area to yourself, and the air system is pretty quick to take out stinky odors and move it along. They're in a capsule. They're in smaller than this table for people. So privacy is a thing you have to grant each other, and they're going to need to go number two in 10 days, certainly, right?
Sitting next to each other like
sitting
this
next
here.
To each other.
And that's how it happens.
There's a curtain. I'd have to see what the latest privacy giving devices are, but nothing more fancy than a curtain. And you're going number two right there. Not to get too, and the human things are what can be annoying, or because there are things you got to deal with. Everyone's got to eat, everyone's got to pee, everyone's got to poop. Yeah. So, and the hole in the toilet on the spacecraft is small. So you practice and you make sure it goes in there, but every now and then you could have an escapee. And you know, that's not something you want to deal with in a small little capsule.
What happens when you have a baby Ruth that's escaped now? What do you do?
It's not pretty. It's not pretty. It's better when you're off by yourself in your own little corner of the space station, and you can deal with your own emergency and not have to tell anybody. But
this is stuff no one thinks
of. No one thinks about it, but it's real.
Yeah.
But those kind of things, and I'm making light of it, but if somebody has a problem and their stomach's not well and they're using the bathroom three times more than everybody else and it's really smelly in there, that could make a third of the mission uncomfortable for everybody. And nobody's gonna hold that against it, because it's just, you're just people, but still, it's a thing.
That is such a great point. And again, something you wouldn't normally think. Imagine, I mean, how close we're sitting.
Come on, we either lay off the spicy food or
having to ask permission. Yeah.
Jeez. Here's the last question I have, Chris. In one sentence, can you tell people listening why this mission matters?
Why this mission matters? I personally think that space exploration unifies countries. And this mission is the first step in ensuring that we have space exploration integrated between multiple countries for a long time ahead of us, particularly when there's so much tension going on, Russia, Ukraine, war, now with Iran, all the stuff out there. Space exploration can bring people and countries together.
It's expensive. And there's always that argument like, oh, we have a lot of other problems that we need to fund. We need to focus on what's happening down here on Earth. What's the pitch that you make to people who think that's a lot of money and we could be taking care of a lot of things down here?
Mm-hmm. I tell them they're right. And it's up for people that dole out the money, our national elected leaders, to determine where those priorities are. My opinion is that, yeah, it does do some economic benefit to the local areas where there's space operations. And that's all well and good. But there's this national pride aspect of seeing an American flag on a rocket, seeing American flag on the shoulder of four people in a spacecraft, and then seeing an American flag and a Japanese flag and a Canadian flag and European flags and a Russian flag all together cooperating. What's the value of that? I don't know. It's a little touchy-feely. It's hard to put a dollar thing on that and say, yeah, that's worth $4 billion of the $17 billion. You can't. It's up to each person to determine that. But I think that we as a nation would regret it if we watched other countries eclipse us in the ability to do successful space operations and we took a back seat.
And we all probably take for granted advancements that have come from the space program over the years that we have no idea came from the space program. And I would imagine that what happens in this 10-day mission is going to go a long way toward convincing people that, yeah, we should keep spending that money. And that's that pressure, I guess, that you were talking about of this has to go right, you know, mm-hmm. because that's part of it, to keep people on board and willing to spend the treasure to get it done.
Yeah, absolutely.
My last thing for you, I would imagine that you can probably, I mean, I really would have liked to have been there for this launch. I used to cover the space shuttle launches in Florida,
mm-hmm.
and those were impressive. Incredibly impressive. I can't imagine this rocket taking, it's an enormous rocket.
Enormous rocket, yeah.
You have to be able to just easily get tickets for this. Why did you decide not to actually go to this?
So as a former astronaut, they did extend the ability to go, but we had other commitments kind of going along. And you didn't, in this time frame, and it kind of, in the last month or so, slid into this week, so... Life goes on. I would have loved to have been there, but
you'll watch it somewhere.
Yeah, I'll be watching.
Will you be
yeah.
nervous?
Yes, because they're my friends. A little bit of nerves and anxiety for the nation because I want it to be successful for the country, but my connection, my friendship, my love of my teammates supersedes that, and so I want it to go perfectly well so they come. I can shake their hand, give them a hug. In a couple months.
Yeah. Are you able to transfer those tickets to anyone else?
I know, you're out of luck, man.
We'll call in sick tomorrow and you know, fly tonight. No, we're all pulling for them as well, Chris. Thanks thanks for your service. Thanks for pulling the curtain back on what happens on so many of these missions and what these astronauts are facing. Really appreciate the insight.
My pleasure.
You know what people are going to walk away from this episode
with. All about the bathroom. I get asked that so many times that I made a YouTube video. You can do Chris Cassidy Space Station Toilet, and if we put animations to it, it's pretty
animated. It's animated. Thank God it's animated.
Yeah.
An escapee. That might be the title of this episode. Chris, good stuff, man.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.